Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. With me today is Stephen V. Ash, author of A Massacre in Memphis, The Race Riot That Shook the Nation 1 Year After the Civil War. The Memphis Massacre took place 150 years ago this May. On March 17th at 6 p.m., Stephen Ash will give a public lecture at Rhodes College based on his book, which is part of a semester-long sequence of events across Memphis intending to commemorate this significant but little-known episode in Memphis and American history. Ash notes in the prologue of his book,
"The riot, which was triggered by clashes between black men and police officers on April 30 and May 1, was an explosion of rage and violence directed against the freed people and perpetrated by the white underclass. Policemen and firemen were among the rioters, as were certain higher-ranking officers of the city government. By the time the rioting ended on May 3rd, at least 40 blacks had been murdered, dozens more wounded, several raped, and many others robbed. Many black churches, schools, and residences had been torched. The Memphis Massacre was a major development in the increasingly rancorous debate over the future of the South and indeed the whole nation. The Civil War had resolved two momentous, long-standing issues. The attempt of 11 Southern states to gain independence was crushed, and slavery was abolished. But new questions soon arose. How were the seceded states to be restored to the Union? How was the devastated Southern economy to be rebuilt? How were the defeated rebels to be dealt with? And what about black Southerners, whose freedom was assured, but whose status was otherwise undefined?"
Here to help us learn more about the Memphis Massacre and to answer some of these questions is Stephen Ash. Welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you.
Now, Steve, in the narrative section of the book, you go through the events of early May 1866 almost as a series of slow-motion video clips of the incidents as they took place. Give us an overview of what unfolded from May 1st to May 3rd, 1866 in Memphis.
On the afternoon of May 1st, a group of black men were gathering, recently discharged soldiers, black soldiers of the U.S. Army, were gathering on a street in Memphis, drinking whiskey from their canteens and celebrating their recent mustering out from the Army. A group of policemen, white policemen, Irish Americans, approached them, ordered them to disperse. The soldiers, the ex-soldiers, refused. A shouting match resulted, which eventually resulted in a shoving match, and as the white policemen retreated up the street because they were heavily outnumbered by these black men, some of the black men pulled out concealed pistols and fired into the air, trying to speed the policemen along in their retreat. The policemen, thinking they were being fired on, fired back into the crowd blacks, whereupon the blacks returned the fire and two of the policemen were eventually wounded. This shootout was over very quickly. But what happened was the policeman ran to the police headquarters downtown, reported what had happened, and the news spread through Memphis with electric speed. And soon there were mobs gathering downtown, ready to march down to that part of town, South Memphis, where the shootout had occurred. Within an hour or so of the shootout, a mob of policemen and citizens, almost all of them Irish American, were marching towards South Memphis, armed. And as soon as they came to the area where the shootout had occurred, they started shooting black people indiscriminately, men, women, and children. Over the next 36 hours, stretching over 3 days, May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, similar mobs descended on South Memphis and other parts of town, shooting blacks indiscriminately, breaking into their homes, setting fire to their homes, burning down black churches, raping black women. In the end, probably 46 blacks were dead.
On the second day of the rioting, on May 2nd, the carnage dramatically accelerated, and it seemed to be stoked by rumors and by the press from the day before. These rumors and press reports really seemed to fuel the fires. What was being suggested by whites in the community that legitimated the violence that was taking place?
The story that was going around on the streets in the white part of town was that this was a black uprising aimed at murdering all the whites in the city. The thing that originally triggered the rioting, the shootout on the street, was quickly over, the one between the black soldiers. But when the white mobs started sending on the city, they were going there with the idea that a black rebellion had essentially occurred, that the blacks were rising up and intending to slaughter all the white people in the city. So in some ways, the whites were trying to head off what they saw as a black uprising. And this in their minds at least, legitimated the slaughter of black people on the street.
And then what about what was being reported in the newspapers? Because that was slightly different from this kind of paranoid vision of a mass uprising of blacks that were about to take over Memphis.
Well, if you're talking about the newspapers over time, the newspapers over time had been complaining loudly about the blacks. The freed people, they had been recently, almost all of them recently freed slaves, had been flocking to Memphis since the war was over and had been asserting themselves. And the newspapers had been constantly harping on the idea that there were too many in Memphis, they were getting out of control, and that if something wasn't done about them, there was going to be some kind of an explosion. Now, during the riot itself, these rumors were, you know, intensified, and it was believed and reported by the newspapers and on the streets that the blacks were in a full-scale rebellion and that counterforce was needed to put them down.
Now, the horrific bloodshed was one thing, but what was almost as disturbing was that by daybreak on May 3rd, not one black school or black church in the city survived. Can you describe this aspect of the carnage and why you think these institutions were targeted in particular?
There were approximately a dozen or 15 black schools and churches in the city. These had been created in the wake of emancipation. The schools were mostly run by Northerners who had come down, Northern missionaries who had come down to help the freed slaves. The churches were mostly conducted by the blacks themselves. These had become powerful symbols of the freed black community and the potential and the vision, you know, the vision of the blacks' own future, a future of black community and black education and black equality. And that is why the mobs particularly targeted those. Every black church in the city was burned down, and every black school in the city was burned down, everyone destroyed. And this was a warning to the blacks, I think, that their striving for equality would not be tolerated and that they were intended by the whites to remain second-class citizens, if no longer slaves, not completely equal citizens.
I mean, it still, to our ears today, seems amazing that black schools in particular would be targeted. Of course, recent history shows that black churches have also been targeted institutions over a long period of time. There's one quote in the book that stood out for me on this point that it was just shocking. One person declared their intentions to burn every N building, every N church, and every damn son of a bitch that teaches an N, which really sort of synthesizes the wrath and hatred that was fueling this massacre. Now that we have a sense of what's happened, let's try to understand it. You provide the social context in two ways. First, by explaining Memphis history during the Civil War and how this impacted the political economy of the city just following the war. And next, by breaking down the groups who were living in Memphis in the spring of 1866. Let's take these in turn. Can you give us a thumbnail on what Memphis went through during the Civil War?
Memphis was one of the first Confederate cities to fall to the Yankee invaders, just a little bit over a year after the beginning of the war. In June 1862, Memphis was captured by the Union Army and Navy, and they never let it go during the war. So Memphis was actually an occupied city well before the Confederacy laid down its arms. In that time, from 1862 through the end of the war, black people from the countryside flooded into Memphis, black people who had freed themselves or were freed by the Yankee Army from the plantations in the surrounding areas. They came to Memphis because it seemed like a kind of beacon of freedom there. They could be protected there by the Union Army and get away from the plantations where the masters still ruled. And so thousands upon thousands of black people came into Memphis during that time. And at the same time, Northerners, not just Army and Navy personnel, but Northern missionaries and businessmen who would eventually be known as carpetbaggers, also flooded into the city. Some of them just to try to make a living and what they saw as kind of a new frontier, the post-emancipation South, and some of them to, as I said, the missionaries to help the black people. So there were newcomers flooding into Memphis. The black population alone, which stood at about 4,000 before the Civil War, was by early 1866 probably 20,000, a huge mushrooming population of black people and their Yankee friends. At the same time, Irish immigrants were coming in too. There had been quite a number of them before the war. There were more now after the war. And all of these developments were being watched by the white former Confederates, the native Southerners, with great skepticism.
I want to talk a little bit more about each of these various communities and some of the conflicts and interests that they had. But before I do, can you tell us a little bit more about what the political situation was in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War? How had federal law legislated who could vote and how power itself operated within the city just after the Civil War?
It was a very interesting and complex political situation in the city. The city was under military rule until the Civil War ended in about June of 1865. At that point, the army allowed the civil authorities to take control. However, the army kept troops there, but the civil authorities came back into control. However, no one who formerly had supported the Confederacy was allowed to hold office or vote, and no black person was either. This left pretty much only the Irish immigrants and the German immigrants, and especially the Irish, who were entitled to vote. Therefore, the city government in 1865, in June of 1865, was basically taken over by Irish immigrants. The mayor was Irish, most of the city officials, aldermen, and almost the entire police force and fire department, all Irishmen. So the city was not actually in the hands of the former Confederates. It was in the hands of Irish Americans, basically. And so they were the ones that were controlling all the city institutions and the police department.
Tell us a little bit more detail about these recent Irish immigrants. The Irish begin to come to America in the 1840s and 1850s as a result of the potato famine. They find their way into Memphis. What are the numbers of Irish people here? What's their social class? What's their social situation?
There had been Irish immigrants, as I said, well before the war in some numbers, but they came in greater numbers during and after the war. Some of them now were well-educated and professional people, but the great majority, poor, unskilled, in some cases illiterate, and they took the lowest class of jobs, you know, if they were lucky, the laboring, you know, unskilled laboring jobs. And because of that, they were in competition before the Civil War. They were in competition with the slaves. And they came to hate black people in America in general and the slaves of Memphis in particular. And this attitude continued after the war. The Irish had it in for the black people, and the black people were no friends of the Irish either. So there was great racial antipathy, and it grew partly out of just sheer racism, but it grew partly out of, too, this economic struggle between the underclasses, the Irish, the unskilled Irish, and the unskilled slaves who were competing for jobs both before the war and especially after the war when the great number of blacks flooded into the city. There were probably at that time, as I said, there were 20,000 blacks. There were probably 4,000 or 5,000 Irish Americans in the city in that period immediately after the war.
And one of the things that you explain, and it's really important that you do, because it is largely Irishmen who are on the front lines of actually carrying out the violence and the massacres, is that when the Irish came into America, they themselves had been the objects of racial contempt. They weren't quite seen as fully white. They're not quite white. And they're seen as kind of the unwashed masses. They're Catholics, they're bumpkins, and then they're also competing very directly with blacks for jobs. Let's talk about the rest of the white population, the other three quarters of white folks who are here. First of all, just starting a little bit with the other kind of immigrant population, that is so-called Yankees who are coming down into Memphis.
The Yankee population, as I said, started coming to Memphis as soon as it was captured in June of 1862. There were Army personnel, Navy personnel. There were a large number of U.S. troops stationed in the city, white troops, as occupation troops during and after the war. And at the same time, a lot of businessmen came in, especially after the war, many of them looking for business opportunities, just as many were going west at that time. Many, when the Civil War was over, saw the South as kind of a new frontier of business opportunity. And then there were also, as I said, the missionaries who came down. Some of them preachers, most of them teachers. And these were idealistic, mostly young men and women who had come out of the abolitionist movement of the North and saw this now as their opportunity to actually come South and really do something now that the slaves have been freed, their idea was now we will raise them up to equality. They had a very paternalistic attitude towards the freed slaves. They really did believe they wanted to help the blacks, but at the same time, they were certain that the blacks needed a lot of uplifting. They drank too much, and they used tobacco, and they danced, and their religious meetings were too noisy and emotional. And so these Yankee missionaries were trying to reform the blacks, not only to elevate them through education, but to turn them into kind of a middle-class Americans.
And their paternalism was very different from the paternalism of the rebels. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking to Stephen Ashe, author of A Massacre in Memphis, the race riot that shook the nation 1 year after the Civil War, who will be joining us in Memphis several times this spring as part of a citywide commemoration of the Memphis Massacre. He'll be at Rhodes College for a free and open lecture on March 17th. So tell us a little bit more about Rebel Memphis, about their paternalism, about their attitudes towards Yankees, towards the Irish, towards the blacks, the other folks who are in Memphis in 1866.
The native Southerners in Memphis, the native white Southerners, who had almost all, to a man and woman, supported the Confederacy, were of two minds about black people, but they did agree in certain essentials. Their attitude towards black people was that slavery had been the best condition for them because blacks were not equal, could never be equal, and at best should be hewers of wood and drawers of water for the superior white race. In some cases, this translated into kind of a white paternalism. Some whites really did believe that they wanted to do the best for the black people. That meant keeping them in their place while doing what they could to make their lives more comfortable. Others were out-and-out racist, ready to use violence to keep the blacks in their place. But the attitude of all the whites was emancipation had been a big mistake, that once blacks were freed from slavery, they were by nature bestial in some ways, dangerous, potentially dangerous, and they would have to be controlled some way. And how they were to be controlled now that slavery was abolished was a problem that the white people anguished over. To some, the answer was paternalism. Well, we show them that we're trying to help them and try to get them to go along with us and with the understanding that they will remain second-class citizens. Others said, we're just going to have to use violence. But the Yankees would not permit violence against slaves anymore. The federal authorities would not permit the reinstitution of slavery in any form. And the Freedmen's Bureau was there, a government agency along with the Army, a government agency that had the power to interfere in black-white relations and would not stand for, you know, outright abuse of the black people or institutionalized abuse. And so the white people were in a quandary, you know, how are we going to reestablish our society with these blacks loose?
So there's about 20,000 blacks, quote-unquote, loose in Memphis now. The demographics of the city have really changed. Tell us a little bit more about the black community, which is half the population in Memphis right after the Civil War.
Well, they were crowding into Memphis because, as I said, the plantations, even after the war, with slavery abolished, plantations were not places where most black people wanted to be. The cities where the Union Army was, where the missionaries were establishing schools, and where the black communities were forming around the churches, these were beacons to the freed people. So they're flooding in there, and there were probably too many for the jobs that were there. And many of them lived in terrible conditions, you know, in shanties. But to them, it was worth it to get away from the plantations, and they would just try to make the best living they could. The white people, both Irish and native whites, saw this, of course, as just an overwhelming flood of indolent blacks who must be gotten rid of at some point, or at least their numbers reduced, and brought under control through legal or other means. But in the eyes of whites, Irish and native white alike, there was just a huge flood of blacks coming into the city, uncontrolled. The newspapers played up every incident of black crime. And there was a lot of black crime. There's no getting around it. There was a lot of, you know, white crime, too. But the newspapers played up the black crime. And it seemed to white people by the spring of 1866, it seemed that they were on the verge of just being inundated by this wave of black crime. So there was a lot of racial tension there.
And part of what you explain, because you open with scenes, for example, of dawn in Memphis with blacks going to work all across the city. Blacks were hardly indolent, as you've already explained. They were beginning to form schools and churches and to establish an African-American community. And that is precisely what ends up getting burned to the ground and targeted in the course of these horrific massacres. Now, in the aftermath of the massacres, there are several investigations that followed. Investigations by the military, the Freedmen's Bureau, but also by a committee of Congress that was in the midst of debating the 14th Amendment. The Congressional Committee actually released two reports, and these differing accounts kind of contain in micro the two different narratives about the riot that emerged in its aftermath. One, the official report that led to radical Reconstruction and African-American equality, and another that fed into Jim Crow America. Tell us about the congressional reports and how they were an index of the inherently opposed narratives that emerged after the Civil War.
In the wake of the massacre, Congress appointed a three-man committee to go to Memphis, take testimony, and examine documents and compile a report on the riot, its causes, its origins, its consequences. And that three-man committee was composed of two Republicans and one Southern Democrat, a Kentuckian. They took testimony for several weeks, interviewed hundreds of witnesses, and also gathered the testimony that had already been taken by an Army Investigating Commission and the Freedmen's Bureau investigators. With all of this information, they returned to Washington and that summer compiled a report, or as you said, two reports. The two Republican committee members compiled a report that insisted that the newspapers had had a lot to do with stirring up the racial tension in the city, that the rebel newspapers were behind it, that the Irish had carried out the massacre, and that the targets were not only blacks, but also the Yankee friends of the blacks in the city. And that the final message of that majority report by the two Republicans was that the white South cannot be left alone to deal with the blacks in their own ways, because if they do, this is what is going to result. We've just seen what's going to happen. We've just seen in Memphis what is going to happen if the white population of the South is left free to deal with the blacks in their own way. So this fed into very much into the big debates about what is federal policy going to be about reconstructing the South and protecting the freed people, dealing with the white South, and restoring the South to the Union. This was very much a part of that discussion. On the other hand, the minority report by the Kentucky Democrat represented the feeling of not only white Southerners, but Northern Democrats too. There had been a lot of opposition to emancipation in the North among Democrats during the war. And a lot of Democrats agreed with Southern whites that emancipation had been a mistake, and that their interpretation of it was that the blacks had started this mess. While they regretted the awful carnage that had resulted in Memphis, they said, in fact, the black people had brought it on themselves by their intolerable behavior and insistent demands since they had been freed. And that is the story that persisted in the white South in the years of Reconstruction and among Northern Democrats, too.
It's important to remember that this story goes national. It goes national very quickly. It becomes part of these national debates, as you've said already, about what to do about reunification and reconstruction. Tell us a little bit more about what the direct historical impact was of the Memphis massacre. What was its immediate significance?
As you say, the news of the riot went all across America. It was the biggest news story outside of Washington, D.C. since the surrender of the Confederate armies and the end of the war. What happened was it came in the middle of the great debate and the great battle being waged in Washington between the Republican-dominated Congress and the Democratic president, Andrew Johnson, over the future of the South, over how Reconstruction should be carried out and how the South should be readmitted to the Union. Johnson insisted, he being a Southern Democrat, although a Unionist during the war, the Southern states must be restored to the Union as quickly as possible and without too many demands, that white Southerners should be basically left alone to reconstruct the South on their own and to deal with the freed people as they saw fit, as long as slavery was abolished. And that is the way Johnson saw it. the Republicans, representing the majority, not only of the Congress, but the majority opinion in the North, saw the Memphis massacre as evidence that the White South must not be permitted to reconstruct itself, that the federal government was going to have to step in, take a firm hand, keep the rebels under control, protect the freed people, and put the brakes on restoring the southern states to the Union until it was certain that those states were going to be truly loyal and that the blacks in them were protected. And these demands of Congress were embodied in the 14th Amendment. And Congress, by that time, had a veto-proof majority and was able to pass all the legislation it wanted, including the 14th Amendment and later the Reconstruction Acts, that forced the White South to give rights, including eventually the right to vote, to the freed people, that guaranteed equal rights under the law to the freed people, and Congress triumphed, at least in the short run.
We've already indicated that there was an enormous amount of historical evidence that was gathered about what ended up happening at the time as a result of these investigations on the Memphis massacre. But today, few people, even in Memphis, know this history. You write in the last line of the book, "Perhaps the sesquicentennial in 2016 will provide an opportunity to rectify this lapse of memory, to acknowledge publicly the screams and groans of the dying victims at Memphis, to allow their ghosts at last to rest." In fact, under the leadership of Beverly Bond and Susan O'Donovan at University of Memphis, there is a significant network of folks across the city, the National Park Service, the NAACP, and many other partners who are in the process of conjuring these ghosts now, Steve. Why do you think telling these ghost stories is important today?
I think it's important because there is in the general public a great deal of ignorance about the Reconstruction era. The Reconstruction era is one of the most important periods of American history. It's a very complicated period, but it is a period that was enormously influential in shaping the future of America. I mean, I have only to mention that in that Reconstruction period, three constitutional amendments passed, the 13th abolishing slavery, the 14th guaranteeing equal rights for all citizens and including blacks in that definition of citizenship, and of course the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed blacks the right to vote. This was an enormously important period in American history. Most Americans today, I would guess, know nothing more about Reconstruction than what they have seen or read in Gone with the Wind. And it's much more complicated than that, much more interesting than that. And the truth of it is very different from Gone with the Wind. So I'm very glad to see that there is so much attention now being devoted to the Memphis massacre and to the broader history of Reconstruction now, because I think the American public ought to know about it. So often the Reconstruction era is overshadowed by the Civil War. The public has certain tastes, and they like stories of battlefield heroics and great men, but there's interesting things going on in the South and across the nation during Reconstruction that Americans need to know about, and they need to know why it was so important in shaping the future of America.
And obviously, for those of us here in Memphis, it's important to know that Memphis was a hinge to this whole larger period. And as we're seeing across the nation, the issues that were raised in the Reconstruction era, in fact, were never completed. There is work yet to be done, and it's only on the basis of understanding this past with greater clarity than we currently have that we can do that. Stephen Ash, thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint to talk about a massacre in Memphis, the race riot that shook the nation 1 year after the Civil War.
Thank you, Jonathan.
On March 17th at 6 p.m. in the Bryan Campus Life Center at Rhodes College, we look forward to learning more from Stephen Ash during his free and open public lecture, part of a series of events commemorating the sesquicentennial of this race riot that inaugurated the post-Civil War South that will be taking place in Memphis through May. Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. You can podcast Counterpoint by visiting iTunes and searching for WKNO Counterpoint. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening.